The UK Psych Health and Safety and ISO 45003 podcast. The goal of the UK Psych Health and Safety podcast is to be your source of information on psychological injury prevention, health promotion, and best practice. In doing this, we aim to rapidly advance the global practice of psychological health and safety in workplaces and adoption of best practices from the ISO 45003 standard. We will be looking at fully integrated approaches to managing psych health and safety and well-being strategy in the workplace that meet the needs of everyone in the organisation. Your regular host will be Peter Kelly, Senior Psychologist with the UK Health and Safety Executive, and Sheila Lord of BMR Health and Wellbeing. Every week, we will have a guest episode from the fields of health and safety, human resources, psychology, and academia who are leading the way in their corner of the globe.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the UK Psych Health and Safety podcast show. I'm Sheila Lord, and today I'm joined, as usual, by Peter Kelly from the UK HSC. And our guest this week is Laura Thomas, a barrister with a difference. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thanks, Sheila.
Fabulous to have you here. So Laura's an award-winning lawyer with a proven track record and a lot of expertise in regulatory law, health and safety, governance, risk and compliance. And she's also held executive positions at senior levels in the oil, gas and civil engineering industry. And today we're going to be talking with Laura about the legal obligations for employers when it comes to health and safety, and why taking a risk-based approach to workplace mental health is absolutely crucial. So, Laura, why don't you tell us a little bit about you, your career to date, and then we can just dive straight into the topic.
Super. Well, I'll be as short as I can be because I've had a bit of a winding career, Sheila, as I think you know. So it all started, I started as a criminal barrister in Chambers in London 20 years ago now. And I worked in some, I think this is probably where my interest in mental health first started, actually, because I worked in some really hard-hitting, tragic cases. I was part of the prosecution team in the first Damilola Taylor prosecution. I was part of the prosecution team that prosecuted Levi Belfield for the multiple murders of young ladies in Southwest London, including Marsha McDonald, Amélie de Lagrange, Kate Tweedy, and some really hard-hitting stuff that I dealt with in my early 20s. And I think I then started to think, I'm not sure criminal law in its sort of traditional sense is where I want to be. So I did as a comment for a while to the Health and Safety Executive. I worked in their solicitor's office for a number of months. And then I started getting prosecution cases from the HSC. So I would prosecute sometimes alone, sometimes with a QC in some of the major health and safety prosecutions of the time. I then decided London was it for me. So I moved out and joined a law firm, Birkitts LLP, where I set up and grew their health and safety and regulatory practice. And so for 12 years, predominantly defended in health and safety cases, ranging from multiple fatalities through to disasters, through to environmental incidents. And I then thought, well, okay, I've done this now. I'm kind of where I wanted to be professionally, but actually what I haven't ever done is try to put into practice what I'm telling businesses they need to do. So for the last couple of years of my time at Birkitts, I predominantly advise boards on strategy, health and safety strategy. And I thought I need to understand how we implement these strategies. It's all very well having the theory, but I need to understand the practice. So I moved over to industry. I was Executive Vice President Corporate Risk for an oil and gas subsea services group globally. And then I did a stint as a legal and QHSC director for Jackson Civil Engineering. So, interesting times. During my legal career, I've also sat as a deputy traffic commissioner for anybody who knows anything about the regulated transport industry. And I've also sat as a non-executive director on Logistics UK. So quite varied, not kind of where I thought I'd be when I first started out. But now I work for myself predominantly. So I'm director of Consultee, And we help businesses with their health and safety strategy and culture, and using a very people-centered approach.
Fantastic. That's an excellent, excellent background to what really comprehensive. So, you know, we could probably have a podcast episode, I think, that would last all day on that.
I think so, yeah.
But let's talk about kind of the world that we're in today and mental health. And, you know, the obvious thing is where we're at right now with employers, with workplaces, and the global impact of COVID on our mental health. And kind of what your thoughts are on what that looks like with employers and their responsibilities as we start to transition, hopefully continue to transition people back into the workplace.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all agree COVID was a huge shock to everybody, both in the workplace and out of the workplace. And I recall that when COVID hit, I was working for the global offshore services, subsea services group. And we had people stuck offshore. We had people stuck quarantining in hotels for weeks. And suddenly my job changed pretty much overnight, I would say. And I suspect other people can sort of identify with this, from being quite an operational, safety-focused role to suddenly being much more focused on mental health and well-being. And it was a bit of a shock to the system, I think, for everybody. But what it has demonstrated, what COVID has demonstrated, it seems to me, is the importance that health, mental health, and well-being need to play in business strategy. I mean, it's we all had our crisis management procedures that we pulled off the shelf and thought, oh, this is what we need to do, because we'd written those, because that's quite an easy, tangible thing to do. What I don't think many businesses had done is thought, oh, what about the well-being and mental health element of all of this? Because that was where we saw the huge, huge impact.
Absolutely. So you talk there about how your role changed from very operational to very people-centered in terms of skills. So let's just kind of dig into that a little bit more, because, you know, we've gone from being managers and operational people to actually having to be human beings in the workplace, which is something that we've traditionally kind of gone, oh, I'm going to walk over the threshold into my place of employment, I'm going to forget I'm a human being now, and I'm going to turn into an automated manager that's focused on productivity. That takes a different set of skills, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
In that different way. So, you know, where did these skills come from? If we've suddenly had to transition this overnight, have we got a gap in the workplace? You know, how are employers and line managers expected to make that leap?
Yeah, I mean, that is a very good question and not an easy one to answer. I think what I have seen is that it's the leaders that have empathy that have thrived. It's their businesses that have thrived. And I'm sure you know this, but Forbes' recent study showed that empathy is the most important leadership quality to have. And COVID has really brought this to the fore. Those leaders that can't tap into empathy have struggled personally themselves, and their businesses have struggled. There isn't a magic wand, I think, you know, but there are lots of ways that businesses can now approach this. And, you know, I run, for example, a health and safety leadership program, and it's really focused on EQ rather than IQ. And I think that's a huge switch now, you know, thinking about the impact you're having on other people. Empathy, as I said, being central to that. Communication skills, how you communicate. And interestingly, I think one thing that I instinctively did when COVID hit was start really communicating with the business. So every day I would send a daily digest. And it wasn't necessarily anything highbrow. It was how I'd got through the day. You know, it was how I'd managed that day in lockdown. And I remember getting a message back from somebody who I didn't know, who worked in Brazil, who said, thank you so much for your digest, because they're the one thing that I can rely on every day and that's getting me through this, which really touched me. But it's those simple everyday things that I think make a huge difference. It's that everyday conversation you're having with employees. It's the how are you, but the how are you really meaning it and asking twice after you've actually engaged in some sort of discussion about the person and how they are and what they like and what they're doing and, you know, what they ate for dinner, whatever it might be, and really trying to get to the bottom of that and then asking again. So there's lots of different tips and tricks, but there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that businesses have to be alive to this. And if they've got people working in senior roles or management roles, leadership roles, supervisory roles, who need some support with this, then it seems to me that there is an absolute duty on businesses to provide that support. And there are plenty of people out there who can offer it. But times have changed dramatically. When I think back to when I started 20 years ago, goodness, I mean, you didn't bring anything personal to work. Absolutely not. You know, even when I've had my first baby, you know, it was very much, oh, I'm still working on maternity leave, don't you worry. You know, it just, you could not. And you had to have two separate lives. And now we're all realizing that was never going to work. And it certainly isn't going to work in times like this.
I think as well, the nature of work's changed, hasn't it? As technology's changed, we just don't have any off switch. So without that off switch, there has, you know, we have to, if we're not going to draw a line, so there are two sides, and the line where we step over, if those are merging together, we can't just be expected to allow work to merge into life, but not life to merge into work.
Totally agree.
Yeah. So you mentioned there about, you know, this duty of care that we've got. So let's just move on. Obviously, you're a barrister and we've got that background. You know, let's talk then about the Health and Safety at Work Act and the mental health, the health and safety regs. And again, it's something that obviously Peter can talk about till the cows come home.
Absolutely. I know Peter likes a bit of health and safety law, so we won't get him on it for too long.
But again, you know, it's making this clear, isn't it, to our listeners out there and employers out there, that this act does cover mental health, you know. And I've had conversations with people, and I'm sure Peter's had this thrown at him a number of times over the years. Well, it doesn't say mental health in the Health and Safety at Work Act. It just says health, safety and welfare. What would you say to our listeners on that basis?
It's the act has been there since 1974. It talks about health, safety and welfare. Health, mental health is physical health. Health includes our whole body and mind. And it also doesn't, you know, there isn't specific reference in the Health and Safety at Work Act to all the different health elements it could have. It's not designed that way. But the law is there. The law has been there for very many years. The duty is clear. You need to do all that is reasonably practicable to secure the health, safety and welfare of your employees and non-employees. For me, it's clear. It's there. We don't need any law, more law. The law deals with it. What we have to do is start understanding that mental health is physical health. And I think it's quite interesting, and I know Peter will be able to talk about this far more than me, but, you know, the recent HSC Working Minds campaign, it's clear the regulator is focusing on this more. I mean, you know, the fact that Peter is working for the HSC, it's clear that that is a real focus for the regulator. And whilst it's very difficult to point to particular prosecutions that are mental health related, there are signs that this is coming through. So, for example, a recent prosecution of the Office of Rail and Road, ORR, of renowned consultants. That relates to a road traffic incident, essentially. Very, very tragic fatality. And it was found in the investigation of the ORR that the root cause was hugely excessive working hours of those who were involved in the accident. And therefore, they were prosecuted for a failure to secure the health, safety and welfare of employees. And so that, you know, if we need it, is a very good example of the fact that fatigue is now very much in the fore. And we know the link between fatigue and mental health is a very, very strong one. And I know Peter will be able to talk about that a lot more. And I think also when I'm reflecting on my career of prosecuting and defending in very, very serious health and safety incidents over the last 20 years, if I look at the root causes of a lot of those incidents, very many of them can be linked back to mental health. Whether that is, for example, an individual who has accessed moving parts of machinery and suffered a very serious injury for doing so. When you try and dig down as to why they did that, a bit of a bullying supervisor. I was frightened. I felt that I would lose my job if I isolated securely that machine before carrying out any maintenance work. We needed to keep the line running. Well, that is a clear workplace bullying root cause for me. If I think of other incidents, and I can think of one where there was a double construction, double fatality, absolutely tragic case. And then it turned out in the investigation that one of the deceased was going through marital difficulties, had been suffering with his mental health, and it hadn't been picked up in the workplace. So, you know, as I say, there's just two examples, but it's clear to me that even though it's difficult to point to mental health prosecutions, mental health has been a factor in many of the serious incidents that I have dealt with over the last 20 years.
In essence, you know, that from a human factors perspective, these are the performance influencing factors, or PIFs, as they're commonly called. They are what we train our inspectors to look at, whether or not what was happening before the accident, what were the circumstances and the characteristics. And it's interesting, though, for mental health, it's been the civil courts, really, hasn't it, that's set the precedence where individuals have sought to seek compensation to get a response to their mental health being impacted. I'd be interested in your thoughts, because we talk about Walker versus Northumberland County Council as a key seminal case, you know, which set the precedence that Mr. Walker had gone off with depression and anxiety due to work-related stress. He returned to work, no changes to be made to work, and he went off subsequently again. But there was a case, and I'm sure you'll be aware of it, Intel versus Duke, where the case was successful on the first instance of someone being told that they were, that their employee was experiencing work-related stress. I think it's changed. It's been very interesting, because there was the Barber and Somerset ruling, which indicated these 16 elements that had to be there for a successful claim. But then the a couple of barristers took the Equality Act and said, well, actually, vicarious liability exists in the cases of bullying, where people are bullied at work, or they're bullied by people who come into the work. So there has been sort of case law which has established that mental health at work is a case that can be held up in the civil courts. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not, just so we're clear, I'm not a civil barrister, so yeah. I don't do so much work in civil courts. But you're right. It's tended to stay out of the criminal courts for now, albeit, as I say, I can identify it as a root cause in many instances I've dealt with. The civil courts I've seen some of the, the penalties that have been imposed, and huge, huge compensation payouts for mental health and stress. And I think what the point you've made there, Peter, is that courts do tend to follow how society views different elements. And now that we are accepting, much more accepting, that mental health in the workplace is a very relevant issue, And I hope that, you know, for all of your listeners, is not in any way in question. More will follow, Peter. And, you know, we saw this with health and safety prosecutions when, you know, the sentencing guidelines changed very dramatically quite a few years ago, and fines changed from being in the region of £100,000 to millions of pounds for the same incidents. Time had moved on because people were abhorred by the tragedies that were happening in the workplace, and felt that the courts needed to very much mark that. And I think that's exactly the same will start to happen more and more in relation to how the courts look at mental health and stress in the workplace, because we are so much more alive to it now than I think we ever were.
And that's exactly what Andrew Buchanan, who was junior counsel on Walker, said in it when I met him a couple of years back. He said the environment's changing, Peter. That people are much more aware of mental health. And this is before the pandemic. Now, if you were to go into any bar, supermarket, cafe now, and you just sit back and listen, people are talking about mental health now. They're talking about the impact on their mental health of the pandemic. And that's very, very different than a few years ago. And we are aware of we're on the crest of a wave of dealing with what's happened in the last 2 years, with people coming in work, and now we're going back into working from home, etc. We're almost stacking up these huge components, which is mental health is very much a partner in this journey in the pandemic. It's borne out by the fact, you know, I can be doing 3 webinars a day on it if I chose to. So, because people are desperate to know what to do.
I've got a question then for both of you, really. I mean, we're talking about this and we're saying how this is kind of gaining momentum. And a question for both of you, one as a barrister and one as a HSE regulator, is that, you know, what do we think the future of this is going to look like in terms of claims? You know, we're very much in the thick of the pandemic, and we're very much in the thick of, you know, employers settling down. But, you know, we're going to have issues. I hear through friends and through my network of disgruntled employees, because employers are trying to remove the options for flexible working, of people being stressed, put under unnecessary pressures. Do you see that that's going to change from a regulatory perspective, and to seeing more cases in the courts or more settlements out of court? And do we see that moving from civil to criminal cases? There's quite a few questions in there, so it'd be interesting to get each of your thoughts on kind of some of those areas. I'm not very good at asking one question because my brain goes off on a tangent. Do you want to go first, Laura?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to go first. I'll answer some of the questions. I'll answer the ones that are easier to answer, and I'll leave the more difficult ones to Peter. Well, I mean, let's look at the signposts we've got here, okay? I don't remember an HSE campaign focused on mental health that has been so strong as the Working Minds campaign that's been recently launched. Okay, I can't remember that. Peter may tell me there was one, but let's look at that as a signpost. HSE being very clear about their intention towards that, and being very clear with employers that it is their duty to safeguard employees when it comes to stress and mental health. Okay, so for me, that is a clear signpost of the future to come. And I'm looking at it from a prosecution's perspective rather than a civil claims perspective, as I said, because I'm not a civil claims lawyer. But for me, that is a clear signpost. And I think employers would be very foolish not to heed the warnings that signpost gives, and ensure that mental health and stress are very much risk assessed in the same way as any other health and safety issues. I'll hand over to you now, Peter. I think you've got about 6 questions to answer.
Yeah, I mean, essentially the risk assessment is very clear. You know, you have to risk assess all health issues, both physical and mental health. And we've been clear about that in our guidance. And we would expect that to identify what the hazards are and then put preventative measures into reduce those hazards. You know, we have put a lot of commitment through the new campaign into saying this is what we're expecting. If you're to ask, I do believe that we, you know, potentially, as we've seen in the past, we will issue improvement notices. We have yet to take a physical case where it's exclusively on stress. Stress will be a component of why an incident occurred. But let's give you sight to, if you do get an improvement notice, the cost implications of improvement notice are equally quite substantial. But so we've got a criteria, it's on there. It says clearly what we would expect and what we'd look at as a reasonable case to have a look at. And if the right cases come in and they meet the criteria, then they would be looked at for the possibility of you know, further inquiries. The reality is that 17.9 million days lost to work-related stress and 828,000 people off 1 week into the pandemic, which is the most of any occupational health or safety characteristic, then you have to do something and be proactive. And I think for a long time, we've allowed organisations to find their own way through it and, you know, had a softer approach to it. But, you know, I'm fairly clear, and I'm clear when I train the inspectors I work with, that if you're looking at an incident, look at performance influencing factors and give consideration to what whether or not that the incident that occurred happened because of these characteristics. If you come across an organisation or you become aware of multiple cases of work-related stress but no risk assessment, then the foreseeability argument is lost, and there is, you know, you're required to do a risk assessment once you're aware that you have people who are off. And I said to Shizu the other week, why wait until someone cuts their arm off on a guard on a machine before you put a guard on? And it's the only thing at the moment that we wait until someone's ill before we react. If we'd done that with asbestosis and not reacted, we'd be in an entirely different place than we are now. Welding fumes, latex, you know, and go through all of them, can't I, Laura? And it's about acting to prevent. And the principle of the health and safety law is prevention, not cure. It's to prevent illness occurring.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's a really, sorry, Sheena. I think it's a really relevant point there, Peter. I mean, people think that health and safety law is only really engaged when there is an incident. That is not the case. It's risk. It's all about risk, health and safety law. And you can have a health and safety prosecution without there being an incident. And I think people forget that sometimes. And I have dealt with a number of health and safety prosecutions where there was no incident. Nobody was hurt as such. You know, nothing fell down. But it's exposure to risk that's the issue. So, Peter, you're absolutely right. And I couldn't underline it any more strongly. It's you must take a risk-based approach to this, because if you are exposing employees or non-employees to risk, then in theory you are breaking health and safety law.
And you wouldn't do it on a lathe.
No, exactly.
Because you say, I'm gonna put this barrier, this guarding in front of it to stop it. And that's effectively what we're doing with stress. What we're saying is put a barrier up, put a guarding up between the job and the individual, and protect them from what might be there. And when you do that, you're in the prevention zone. The moment someone's hand is, you know, they've got a glove and their hand's inside a lathe, it's a different, you're looking at an entirely different thing. I mean, that was a terrible illustration, but I'm trying to say, this waiting until it happens is weird, because we just don't do it on any other health issue, which is just strange. And yet we have all of these health and well-being initiatives and everything else, and it's about teaching the individual to manage, teaching the individual to cope, teaching the individual to do that, not about actually assessing the workplace and looking at, is there something inherently about the way we work here that is causing the problem?
And again, I think maybe historically, just picking up on what you were saying earlier, Laura, even going back to when we were talking about skill sets, is potentially organisations haven't really known how to manage psychological risk and actually what to do when it comes to managing psychological risk. But actually, that information is now out there. The how-to, there is enough guidance out there, and it's been published in the form of an ISO standard specifically on how to manage psychological risk within a health and safety-based approach. So we've got the approaches, we have the skill sets to take a risk-based approach to health and safety, and we're just saying these are the additional factors. ISO 45003 is giving you a bunch of individual factors. These are what they are: bullying, harassment, demands, control, support. And this is how you need to then start applying those principles. So we're taking away almost those excuses now, or those reasons for not having done this. I mean, what are your thoughts now on standards like 45003 that are out there to provide this guidance for employers?
I absolutely welcome it. I mean, you know, it's a fantastic addition to the ISO standards that are already out there. I know a huge amount of work's gone into it. And I think, you know, it's a roadmap there. It's all clear. It's a roadmap. It's clear. It's accessible. You know, I think it's great. And I think any employer that doesn't take heed of 45, of at least the guidance in 45003, even if you don't want to go down the certification route, you know, if you're not taking heed of the guidance of 45003, then you are not adequately considering all of the risks attendant upon your undertaking. And I think, you know, it's all there, it's all clear, it's accessible, use it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I'm finding that, you know, I mean, in my interactions with people, it noticeably increased on Friday from like, yeah, to, oh, wow, what are we going to do now? Not again. I'm not ready for it. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? And we're now in our fourth period of lockdown, and there's still a heightened anxiety the moment you mention, not lockdown, sorry, the moment you mention from working from home. It dips up, because actually we need to learn from each of the times that we've been working from home what we need to do. Simply providing someone with a phone and a computer and saying, get on at work, and then not doing the other elements of work, which is the tea point conversations, or, you know, the social element of work, the face-to-face discussions where you can visualize what your colleague is doing in that scenario. All of those things have to be recreated in the virtual world. And we didn't, and people have not, in the early stages of both of the first couple of work from home times, people and organizations weren't quite connected. And I still think the problem is we've still got people, organizations now, that are going to do it poorly.
Yeah. I mean, I totally see that, Peter. I think, you know, I suppose if an organization hasn't done it well for the last three times, then the employees are, it's that sort of sense of dread, isn't it? You know, if you've had a bad experience two or three times, you're really not going to look forward to it a fourth time. And I think the difference perhaps now is, and I don't know what your view on this, Peter, is that perhaps the first time it was a bit of a novelty. You know, people, it was like, oh, this is all a bit different. Okay. All right. We've got this all sort of, and there was a slight, I know it sounds wrong, but there was a slight sort of, I think novelty is the right word. You know, it's a little bit different. We're not used to this. And there was a sort of, oh, this is all quite nice for a while. And then suddenly we realized actually it wasn't very nice at all. It was really quite unpleasant at times. And I think if businesses didn't handle it right at the start, there's going to be a cumulative effect for employees, isn't there? But that doesn't mean that you can't get it right now. But as you say, there's got to be those frequent touch points. There's got to be that communication. There's got to be those video calls, those, you know, that keeping on top of making sure your people are happy and well.
There's got to be informality if we've got to create an environment where people are allowed to have the other aspects of work, that informality of being there. You know, I know organizations that track people's on time by their messenger service. Well, that's not quality. That's not quality line management. That's transactional management, which is I don't trust you. And you said it before, leaders who have integrity, who have empathy, have flourished during these times, and the organizations have got through. I mean, I think of Timpson and James Timpson. In the first lockdown, James Timpson's company, Timpson, said, right, all of our people, off you go. We'll pay you your salary, and we're going to look after you until you get back in. And each subsequent time we've gone into these working from home and everything else, that organization has consistently come down and said, we're going to look after our people. Now, have any Timpson shops closed during the lockdown? You know what I mean? There is a direct relationship by looking after your employees and a continuity of what happens to you in terms of your businesses and that. And Iceland also have really high rates for well-being, low staff turnover. There's a number of organizations really just get this, which is look after your people, show empathy as a senior manager, and compassion. And it's there. MBAs do not teach people emotional integrity. They teach them about delivering a process and a system, but they forget that the process and system is reliant on an individual working within it. And you've got to design systems to work within people.
And I think, as well, coming back to your experience, Laura, you know, you've worked with governance and risk and compliance. And, you know, I still find that the mental health agenda is still too far away, removed from the board in a lot of instances. And I think, you know, with this corporate responsibility, forget the moral and the legal responsibility, you know, the corporate responsibility, the responsibility to stakeholders, all of this reputational risk piece, you know, really this has to start getting further up that boardroom agenda and becoming a real board level item and not something that we just throw a bunch of mental health first aiders at and some mindfulness classes and a bit of Bendy Brenda on Fridays for yoga.
Yeah, totally agree, Sheila. I think, you know, there's been an awful lot historically perhaps thinking, oh, this is an HR issue. This is an HR issue. No, it isn't an HR issue. This is a governance high level issue. So I used to advise boards for very many years and always used to say health and safety needs to be number one on your agenda at board meetings and discussed, not just number one, but actually discussed and talked about and debated. And that was health and safety. And as I go back to my original point, you know, mental health is physical health. It has to be there. It has to be considered at a top level in detail and not paid lip service to. And I when I go and talk to boards now in my current capacity, I can't make that any clearer to them. You know, we've heard a lot recently about ESG. That suddenly flourished a couple of years ago, ESG, and we all thought, oh, what's that? And I remember having to Google it. I have no idea what ESG is, but people keep talking about it. So, you know, social. Well, I'm sorry, it's as clear as day, isn't it? Our social responsibility isn't just our responsibility for doing a bit of charity work as a business. And, oh, yes, we let our employees every year have a day to go and, you know, clean the beaches or whatever that might be. It's not about that at all. It's about your people as well as other people and looking after your people. And it has to be about that. ESG for me has to be about that. So it's already there. As I said, the law's already there. The acronyms are already there. The point is that we've got to get boards to really believe that that's also what it means.
So how do we do that? I mean, this is the question. If we all knew the answer to, we'd all be...
Well, it's about that. It's about the long road. You know, it's about keeping on and on and on. I remember the days where, you know, health and safety prosecutions, when I first started probably 20 years ago, if you turned up to a magistrate's court and wore a suit and tie and said you were very sorry for severely hurting somebody, you'd probably get £1,000 fine or something along those lines. Now you are getting millions of pounds worth of fine for the same thing. Mm. Rightly so, I might have. And as I said, I think what we're reaching at the minute is we are reaching a pivotal moment when it comes to mental health, because COVID has really blown that up into a big issue. And so it's about continuing that journey. And all it is the continuing messaging. Mm. There's no magic wand. There's no, you know, great thing, but the continual messaging that this has a significant impact. And what I say to boards, if they need it, is I go back to, you know, the facts and figures, because sometimes that's what boards need. And I go back to my experience of serious incidents where companies have been fined millions of pounds for tragedies that have happened, and say, well, in my experience, that wouldn't have happened if mental health had been, you know, at the fore of what you are doing. Healthy, happy people work more safely, in my experience.
Absolutely.
And therefore, it's not going to hit your bottom line if you are looking after the whole person and not just thinking about safety.
And it's actually, it's not just not going to not hit your bottom line. It would actually improve your bottom line.
Totally.
The money not spent on recruitment, the money not spent on additional training, because we've got high attrition rates.
You know, sick days.
25% of a salary you're recruiting for is in your recruiting costs. So if you're constantly having to do that because you've got a toxic work environment where people, you've got a revolving door kind of attrition rate, you know, that's costing businesses a lot of money. And I don't think necessarily that boards always look at that in the right.
No, I think you're right. It's always been seen as a bit of an HR issue. And as you know, as I said earlier, sick days. I mean, I you probably know the figures better than me, Sheila and Peter, but huge amount of money spent on ill health in the workplace, which is directly linked to mental health, stress, workplace stress, well-being. You know, the old I've got a bad back used to be what was used. Now, thankfully, people are feeling a lot more comfortable and confident to say, no, you know, this is a mental health issue. But if you add all that money up, huge.
It's about four times the salary cost for the time the period's off. So if they're on 30,000 a year, they're off for 6 months, it's 15,000. You think that's okay, but the reality is it's 60,000. So numbers start getting very big very quickly, the more people you have off and the longer they're off. But in terms of the languages of the board, I think there has to be a sea change in a couple of ways. One, we have to make reporting of mental health initiatives and programs and what's happening a KPI for the organization. We have to influence your insurance companies to ask the question, are you risk assessing? Because if you are risk assessing, that mitigates the risk they have to pay out. And then, and I think thirdly, we have to get to a position where we don't hide from the board the reality of what's going on. Because people seek to go to the board with the information that gives the most positive outcome, rather than saying to them, actually, we do have a problem here and it's in these areas. Because a board can only respond to what it gets. And I think sometimes you have to have the courage to say, we've got a problem, we need to deal with it.
I think as well, though, that boards also need to have the courage to ask, because they can't just say, well, I didn't know because somebody didn't give me the numbers. Boards need to be asking these questions as well, and really taking that a lot more seriously. I mean, you look back at the guys in France with French Telecom at the time. Think, you know, they went through a period of restructuring because they couldn't get rid of their civil service employees. And out of that, there were 19 suicides and 12 attempted suicides. And for a telecoms company, they were fined just 70,000 euros. And three of the three of the top executives that were kind of behind or held accountable for this were given jail sentences, all of which were suspended. So relatively light sentences. I'm not sure they'd get away with such light sentences today. There needs to be some real board level attention paid to this subject matter now, because it's not going away, is it?
No, I totally agree. And I think a lot of what we're talking about is culture as well, isn't it? Driven from the top. And as you say, I agree with both points of view, actually, because they, I think they complement each other. But if you haven't got a board that's inquiring that's leading from the top, that's making it clear that this is important within the business, then that's where we'll have the issues. And so the businesses where you know, the leaders have not shown empathy during COVID, have not you know, perhaps have not, you know, flouted the rules and regulations, which we know some have, you know, those will be the ones that you know, where the culture is obviously seriously lacking. But I suspect it's going to, you know, it'll hit them. Well, I don't suspect, I know it will hit them, because they will lose employees, they will lose money. And as I said, I come back to my, you know, my thoughts that healthy, happy people work more effectively and more safely.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Laura. And I think we've been chatting for a while now, and I think that's a really great kind of place to kind of wrap up our chat today, because I do think we could talk for absolutely hours on this subject matter. So we have two end of session questions. One key takeaway for employers to bear in mind as we kind of move into 2022 with regards to workplace mental health. And then the second one is a secret guilty pleasure that nobody would guess about you. We had a good
I had fun thinking about that one, Sheila. I'm gonna say it again, because if this is one thing that somebody takes away from this podcast, I'm happy with it. It's that healthy, happy people work more effectively and more safely.
Fantastic.
That's my takeaway here. What is my guilty pleasure? Okay, so I think it's got to be I have Ibiza dance music from 1997. It's quite specific, but Ibiza dance music from 1997, because I spent a summer out in Ibiza having a lot of fun and dancing an awful lot. So whenever one of those songs comes on, I revert back to being very young again and having lots of fun.
Me too.
Do you? Excellent. Let's do it together one day then, Peter. We'll have a good rave.
I went to Defected 2018 in Croatia.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I have to Peter tell you the story about his night with the...
Me and Roger Sanchez became best friends.
Oh, wow. Oh, well, there we go. I'm glad I came up with that guilty pleasure then. There were quite a few others I could have come up with, but that one is obviously a good one.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thank you, Laura, and again, thank you, Pete.
Oh, thank you both for inviting me to speak to you. Really, really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the UK Psych Health and Safety Podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention and the new ISO 45003 standard, follow, subscribe to the UK Psych Health and Safety Podcast at www.ukpsychhealthandsafety.com.